change the world together. Welcome to the Snapcast, the podcast for all nonprofit professionals, bringing you interviews and amazing ideas for nonprofit leaders.
Hello, you are listening to the Nonprofit Snapcast. I'm your host, Mickey Desai. Very happy today to be speaking to an old friend, Salvatore Alimo. Salvatore is an associate professor at Grand Valley State University. How are you doing, Sal?
Good, Mickey. And yourself?
I'm doing great, thanks. What are you teaching at Grand Valley State University? Do you have courses this semester with pandemic?
I do. I have three graduate courses, history and ethics of philanthropy in the nonprofit sector, strategic management and planning, and nonprofit management, three graduate level courses this semester.
Are you doing them in person or are you doing the virtual thing?
I had to do the virtual thing because none of them met social distancing guidelines based on the size of the classroom and the number of students enrolled. Oh. So I was forced to make the switch.
Yeah, well, good for you. I'm glad you're able to do that. I'm sure it's not as satisfying as being in person, but it's the smart thing to do.
It's not for me. I know everybody has a different opinion, but I think in person is still the best, at least for the topics that I teach.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, you know, maybe we can get into that. I know that the topic you suggested for us today for the Snapcast was being able to talk about some of the imperfections of philanthropy and what might be necessary for philanthropy to reach its potential in impacting society. I think that's going to be a fascinating topic to get into. How do we get started?
Well, I think the best way to get started is just to remind everyone, and I have to remind myself of this sometimes too, Mickey, that our country has made this collective decision, either subconsciously or consciously in some regard, that we are going to continue to rely more and more on philanthropy to provide important services for our citizens. And that's due to a number of reasons. One being this trajectory of devolution as opposed to evolution, and which really describes how our federal government is weaning itself off of getting in the, you know, being in the game of social services. It's typically demarcated at the time of the Reagan administration when he got elected in 1980. Mm-hmm. But we can't blame this on any one party because whoever's been in administration has continued devolution. So the nonprofit sector has to keep picking up the slack. And I think if we're going to continue to rely on it more and more for important things, it is subject for critique and should be critiqued precisely because of that importance.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back to that historical perspective. What exactly did happen with Reagan? And why do you think none of the followers have changed it? Is that not a fair thing to talk about?
Oh, it's a great question, and it's one that needs untangling and unpacking. Mm-hmm. So various sources in the literature will talk about the extent of the cuts that the Reagan administration made in terms of funding the nonprofit sector, and they usually all wind up at about 25% from what was done before he came into office. He also initiated a voucher system where citizens could use vouchers to purchase particular services, typically within healthcare. So that brought in the more of the commercialization and marketization to where nonprofits and for-profits were then competing with each other that provided similar services. Some may argue that cuts in government funding inspired private giving. Others argue, well, no, private giving actually didn't increase, it decreased because it was crowded out by more of the government contracting relationship where the government was now going to contract out to the nonprofits to provide those services. Some people look at it as a positive thing too, and they say that the sector actually grew. It grew during this period. And mm-hmm. we probably can figure that out in that entrepreneurs typically will establish or found nonprofits and kind of worry about how to fund their organizations later. You know, mm-hmm. they see a need in society, they're passionate about it, they get entrepreneurial about it, and they say, well, I'm just going to start my own organization and try to address that problem, and we'll worry about scrambling to get the funds to keep it going later. So I think that's really what got it all started. You know, if you remember, President Reagan, one of his campaign slogans was, government's not the solution to our problems, government is the problem.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he ran on that. So this is when some of the anti-government political climate started to creep in. I don't know that it's ever left us. Even Bill Clinton said the era of big government, it's over. So I think all the administrations after that have followed this trajectory because maybe they feel that the government is not the best entity to provide these services due to maybe some bureaucratic inefficiencies. But I also think it's because the nonprofit sector is there. It's a convenient offloading point. We have this sector that we can, you know, offload these responsibilities to, and the sector somehow magically rises to the occasion and provides the services. But you and I both know that the nonprofit sector is not an adequate safety net. It's not designed to be one. It probably never will be, as long as we have our current system.
Right. Well, I was going to ask, how do we move it to a place where it can be? I mean, is it something that we privately, or should it actually be in the hands?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, everybody's going to have their own take on what role government, the market, i.e. business, or the nonprofit sector should have in our lives. And, you know, you could have 30 people in the room have 30 different answers to that question.
It's true. Yes.
Because we all have our political ideology and bent on what that looks like. What I would say is, the nonprofit sector, as important as it is not a good choice for a safety net for critical needs of citizens, because it exists in a world of two things: uncertainty and voluntary action. So I always use the metaphor of you're in the circus and you are the guy on the high wire. You're doing the high wire act.
Right.
And the maintenance guy down below says, he looks up at you and says, "Hey, Mickey, be very careful because the volunteers didn't show up tonight. You don't have a safety net. So really be careful and don't fall off that wire."
Right.
So, you know, do we want that? For critical services of the three sectors, the only one that I see that's capable of ensuring that we get those services, that's the key word, ensuring, is the one that has the coercive power of legislation and taxation, and that is government.
Right, right.
But when you say that, people trot out the term socialism, they get really scared. And I'm not advocating we become a socialist nation. I'm just saying that if we as a citizen determine that services are more so as rights or things we have to have or that should be guaranteed, healthcare being the current poster child for that,
right,
then really only government can take care of that. The market and the nonprofit sector are not going to.
I mean, I recently had a discussion with some really staunch libertarian friends on this entire topic, and they're in favor of getting the alienationary sector to be able to handle more of what the government should not be handling. And I keep saying to them, well, we have tried that and it has not been very successful. And we're sort of touching on that now. You know, you've just said it, that for certain critical things, we shouldn't leave it up to the nonprofit sector. But but there's still a lot of work for the nonprofit sector to do. I'm sure you'd agree about that.
There definitely is. And, you know, one example is, I'll give an example here in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Catherine's Health Center is a free health clinic. And the general public here thought that with the Affordable Care Act, places like Catherine's Health Center would go out of business because everybody would magically have access to health care and there would be no need for free clinics anymore. And that wasn't the case. There's always going to be some people that are marginalized or at the fringes that slip through the cracks and that need those services. So Catherine's Health Center had to embark on this PR campaign to tell people, hey, just because ACA is in effect does not mean that we are not still getting patients showing up at our door.
Right.
So to your point, I think the sector is always going to have a place in our society. And I actually would hope it would, because a lot of innovation and a lot of great things have happened out of the sector that we can be thankful for. I just don't think it's the best place for things that we look for to be guaranteed more as a right than a service.
You know, so far in this discussion, we've sort of taken a look at philanthropic works, or at least nonprofit actions in connection with government and you know, whether or not it's empowered by a legislative body. But what about the other side of philanthropy? What about private grant makers, you know, the actual philanthropic organizations? Are they also part and parcel of this imperfections that we might be talking about?
I believe so. And I'm not alone in that thought. In the last 10 years, this has been an uptick in people writing books and journal articles and op-eds and blogs about this topic. You know, you have Anand Giridharadas's best-selling book, Winners Take All. You have Robert Reich from Stanford, not to be confused with the other Robert Reich, the former labor secretary.
Right.
His writings about how we're not getting the most out of philanthropic foundations. You have Aaron Dorfman's organization in D.C., the National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy, that pushes back on foundations and tries to make them accountable. And Phil Buchanan's organization, the Center on Effective Philanthropy in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So more books, more articles, more organizations trying to get the philanthropic funding world to try to do what they see as the right thing. Mm-hmm. So I think that pressure is going to increase. I think it's amplified in times of crisis like we are in now. Mm-hmm. So some of the specific things we might look at, you know, foundation, the private and independent foundations are still only required to pay out 5% of their assets annually. And that's from the Tax Reform Act, which was 1969. So here we are, mm-hmm. 51 years later, and that 5% hasn't budged. if you were due to do a random study of independent foundations and you charted a graph of 100 of them in terms of their payout percentage, you could almost just about write a flat line, a straight line at the 5% mark. Huh. So the federal law treats it as a required minimum, but foundations largely treat it as a maximum. And some large foundations pay financial advisors good money to do what? Advise them on how to stay close to that 5% and not go over it. So, you know, what would they normally be paying tax on that wealth as opposed to 5% on their assets? And that's what Robert Wright gets at. And are we getting the most out of philanthropic foundations? Right. You know, it's up for debate.
Yeah. So apart from possibly getting into legislation and advocating for change, what can people like you and me do to help fix the things that are broken?
That's a great question. You know, I'm doing my little part here as a professor, but, you know, it's one heart and mind at a time, I guess. I think awareness, I think advocacy, and not advocacy necessarily to change policy in the way that you're just saying, but advocacy in terms of public awareness. I mean, Mickey, I tell people, and I remind my friends and colleagues who work at foundations, that the average citizen does not know what the heck a foundation is.
Right, right.
You know, you say foundation, you know, some particularly females are going to talk about that's the base, the cosmetic base for the makeup that they put on their face. and then other people are going to say, well, that's in the construction site. That's that concrete base of a building, right. You know, they're not going to gravitate to the philanthropic foundation. So we should start with the average citizen and educating them that there's this entity called a foundation that exists out there. And here's what it's designed for. Here's what it does. And here's what it's required to do. Because, you know, they're tax exempt, Mickey. That's the point.
Right.
They're given the privilege, not the right, but the privilege from the federal government that they're tax exempt in return for providing a social good, just like their nonprofit grantees that they fund. Same thing. So if that's the case, in my mind, we as citizens, if we were going to allow these things called foundations to exist and let them have that privilege, we should be expecting something in return. And it's partially public funds. And I know a lot of foundation people don't like to hear this, but if it's tax money deferred, it's not completely private wealth. It's partially public funds as well. Right. Due to that, the deferred tax revenue that we're giving up. So if we're giving something up, we as citizens have a right to critique and push back on that. But it all starts, back to your question, it all starts with awareness. And we've got a ton of work to do in that area.
Right, clearly. My stupid question here is, you know, you spoke a moment ago about how foundations are required to give away a minimum of 5% of their assets every year. Mm-hmm. Is that the correct way to say it? And what then happens to a foundation if they give away, say, 30% of their assets every year? Doesn't that endanger the actual fiscal stability of the foundation itself? And, you know, so that if you do that too many years in a row, will it go away?
Yes. The answer is yes. Mm-hmm. 30% is quite a lot.
Yes.
So, you know, the argument from the foundation world has always been, if we go above 5%, it will severely threaten our ability to remain in perpetuity. Now, a couple of things about that. I have yet to see an economist weigh in on this and crunch the numbers and say, yeah, you know, if you go to 6%, that's going to really hinder your ability to keep all those assets and stay around forever. So I have yet to see that. Secondly, it raises the ethical question of should they be remain in perpetuity anyway? Now, there are some foundations that have spent down. Atlantic Philanthropies has been spending their assets down. John Hunting, a local philanthropist here in Grand Rapids, has spent down two foundations.
Oh, wow.
And when I asked him, he was a guest speaker in one of my classes a few years ago. I asked him, why did you do that? And he says, well, I see it as an ethical issue. Why should I keep stockpiling money and have it, you know, continue to grow, not pay taxes on it, while metaphorically speaking, there are fires burning all around us? There are problems today So why should I sacrifice supporting problems of today, which are real because we can see them, touch them, smell them, and trade them for problems that may come later on? And I said, well, but what happens if everybody starts spending down? He says, there will always be another wave of philanthropists and another wave of foundations come along to replace the ones that spend down. He says, I'm not worried about that. But he's in the extreme minority. Most foundations do want to be around forever.
Right. Yeah, it does sort of raise a question, like what if you were to spend down a body of wealth but solve a societal problem in the process, wouldn't that make sense to just go ahead and spend it down and not worry about being around for forever and ever?
I think John Hunting would give that a resounding yes.
Yes.
To even put a dent in all fairness, to put a crimp or a dent in a complex social problem that has been around for centuries, you're going to need to ramp up a large amount of money and get to what Steven Goldberg talked about in his book, Billions of Drops for Millions of Buckets. You have to ramp it up to the million-dollar level because these are million-dollar level problems.
Yeah.
So, but unfortunately, we have fragmentation. We have many small foundations giving many small amounts of money to many small nonprofits. So we don't have that coalescing or coagulating of funds to the level where we can ramp them up and really put a serious dent in those issues, with the exception of a few, maybe the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation with education and global health and a few others.
Right. Sal, I'm sure we could talk about this for a long time, but we've run out of time. If a listener wanted to be in touch with you with any esoteric questions, how would you suggest they drop you a line?
Yeah, they can shoot me an email, alaimos@gvsu.edu, and I will happily respond.
Awesome. Thank you. And thanks for being available to do this recording with me today. I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you, Mickey. I look forward to the next time. I enjoyed it too.
Absolutely.
And to our listeners, thank you as always for joining us for the Nonprofit Snapcast. We value your comments and feedback via the website. That's nonprofitsnapcast.org. And if you have any questions about the consulting work that we do, please visit nonprofitsnapshot.org. That's nonprofitsnapshot, not to be confused with Nonprofit Snapcast. nonprofitsnapshot.org. Click on the consulting tab at the top of the screen and you'll see the list of things that we're currently doing in partnerships with consultants across the country. In the meantime, thanks again for joining us. We'll see you with another episode in a few days.
This has been the Snapcast. Thank you for joining us.